Whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. The case we're here on today on State versus Barnett arises from a conviction for assault first and armed criminal action in the city of St. Louis, wherein the defendant was convicted of stabbing the victim, Chris Schmiederer, and causing serious physical injury. The only question on appeal with this court is whether the trial court erred in refusing to submit defendant's proffered self-defense instruction. And if so, were defendant's rights violated and for fair trial and due process, and should the case be reversed and remanded? The court has previously set out its legal framework for submitting self-defense instructions. First requirement is that the defendant submit or inject the issue of self-defense. How does he do that? He's got to support it by evidence. What kind of evidence? How much evidence? The court has told us that the standard is known as substantial evidence. What does that mean? It means that evidence is just simply putting the matter at issue. It doesn't mean any more or greater evidence just because we're using the word substantial. It's just evidence that can establish a theory or can support different conclusions. And if there is substantial evidence of that, then the defendant is entitled to a self-defense instruction. The court has also suggested in prior case law that this is a very minimum hurdle. So the main issue here is we've got some evidence that we've got to submit to get a self-defense instruction, but what is it?
Is it then below the standard for making a submissible case?
I would think it is. I think as long as there is a minimum amount of any plausible theory that gets you to self-defense, I think that the court is required to submit on that, as long as there is something to show that there has been self-defense. And the court has said that the self-defense statute is what we need to look to, and is there substantial evidence of the elements within that statute, 563.031.
What are the primary cases that we should look to, and are they consistent or inconsistent on the issue of the standard?
I think that they are. Most recently, the court's ruling in Bruner and also in Smith are important and similar to this case. However, certainly distinguishable, because in both those cases, the court determined that there was not sufficient evidence that would require submission of a self-defense instruction. So in particular, in the Bruner case, that was pending while this case was pending and the order issued, has a very similar fact pattern. In that case, there was a husband ended up shooting the boyfriend of his soon-to-be ex-wife. However, when that occurred, there was no attempt by the victim in that case to have actual physical contact. There was no threat of immediate harm. The victim had threatened to slit his throat in 2 hours. The court said, that's not close enough in time. 2 hours, you got time to get skedaddle and get out of there. And also, there was no weapon, and there was no other evidence from any other witness in that case suggesting the need for self-defense. And in that case, the husband shot the victim. Likewise, in the Smith case, that is also a case where the victim was yelling at the defendant, asked him if he wanted to fight, got within an inch of his face, but also no physical contact, no weapon, no threat of immediate harm. He didn't say, I'm going to beat you up right now, I'm going to kill you right now. He just said, so do you want to fight? So similar problems in both the Bruner and Smith file cases that I believe this case overcomes that minor hurdle.
What about you don't mention the Avery case.
Yes, the Avery, I'm sorry.
Defendant claimed it was an accident.
Yeah, so in the Avery case, He claimed it was an accident. However, and the court said, well, that's inconsistent with a self-defense. However, the court also said that if there is other evidence of self-defense, whether that's from prior inconsistent statements of the defendant, from evidence presented by the state, from third-party witnesses defended by the defendant, essentially any other evidence in the case that would allow for consideration of self-defense, then you have to look at that.
And so what was the other evidence here?
The other evidence in this case, Judge, was, number one, there was a significant issue between these individuals, specifically the victim egging on, urging, and verbally assaulting the defendant in this case. They had a history of it. From the get-go, the defendant first met the victim because the victim came up from behind him at a bar, grabbed him in a headlock, and pulled him off the bar stool. He, from that point on, for whatever reason that's not clear within this case, the victim had it in for this defendant. Anytime he saw him at the bar, he would verbally assault him. He would ask him to fight. He would try to fight with him. The defendant always denied it. He always tried to defuse the situation.
So defendant here claimed no involvement, that I didn't do it. But I thought the law was that the other inconsistent evidence of self-defense has to come from the state or a third party, not from the defendant.
Well, I think, it can come under Westfall. It can come from the defendant alone. And it doesn't have to be just from what the other witnesses said. In this particular case, defendant also testified, not only he testified that he did not stab the victim, but he certainly testified that on the night of the incident, when it had escalated from in the bar to verbal assaults to the victim trying to take a swing at him in the bar, to leaving the bar, to the victim following him out there, the victim telling him he's going to beat him up, to the victim taking a swing at him and telling him he's going to die and having a metal object in his hand, through all of that.
Well, and then very importantly, your client said he hit him, but he denied he used the knife.
Right.
Doesn't this make this case like the Stiers case, where your client didn't claim accident? All those cases say accident is inconsistent. And does not inject, if you claim accident, doesn't inject anything from which a jury could find self-defense.
Right.
But in Stiers, the court said, where you claim to use force but not deadly force, the jury could believe you used force but not believe you didn't use deadly force. It's not inconsistent for you to claim, yeah, I hit him, but I didn't use deadly force, and the jury could disbelieve that part of the evidence. You haven't introduced anything inconsistent, and that's distinct, Stiers said, from the accident cases.
Yeah,
in which you're saying it was totally an accident. Well, then you can't draw from that any inference of self-defense or.
Correct. This case has that slightly different twist on it, where the defendant clearly indicated, yes, we were in a fight.
But it's not slightly different. The law is really well established that it's inconsistent to claim self-defense when you claimed accident, because the state of mind is totally different, and one, you can't infer from by the jury disbelieving part of your evidence, they can't come to the conclusion it was self-defense.
Yes.
But tell me why Stiers is correct, or is the Court of Appeals here correct, that it's totally different when you claim defense, but you simply the evidence, there's contradictory or inconsistent evidence as to how far your defense of yourself went and whether it went too far.
Yeah, well, in this particular case, there's also, and as the court has ruled in many of the prior cases, that if the defendant has also made inconsistent statements that it did in fact happen, that can also be taken into account. And in this particular case, we also have the issue of the police video interview with the individual. And although defendant at numerous times during that video says, no, I didn't stab him, there are numerous times when the officers are saying, yes, you stabbed him, you did this, he was stabbed after he left, and if you're looking at the video, he's saying he's sitting there nodding. He is nodding. That's evidence that the jury can consider and say, yeah, he was admitting that he did stab him. He admits that he's right there to the end, he's fighting him, he pushes him off. We have another witness who says, I watched the fight, I saw the fight, They were fighting together. The victim fell. The defendant took off. No one else came around. I went up and saw that the guy was stabbed. So we have other evidence from other witnesses, and we have prior inconsistent statements by head nodding or even agreeing at some points during the police video that, yeah, I know you guys aren't lying. I know it looks bad for me. I know this happened. So is that evidence that the jury can consider in looking at whether or not he was admitting to it, and that's a prior inconsistent statement that the court can consider? I think so. At no point here does the defendant ever suggest this was an accident. I don't know how it happened. This was clearly, he just denied it. But I think that the court can also take a look at what was also introduced by way of his mental and physical issues that he had, the long history of a brain injury and coma and seizures, and specifically loss of time issues, not realizing things had gone on, really kind of blackout situations. I think that's something that the jury can also take with it and go, okay, it seems like he had to have done the stabbing, right? But how does he say he didn't do it? Well, this is one of the factors from which the jury can infer that, yeah, this may be the factor why he claims that he didn't stab him, because he doesn't recall it, because he has a loss of time on this issue. I think that within this particular case, I think we get over the hurdles that neither Bruner nor Smith got over, because we have an escalation by the victim, not the defendant. There's no evidence the defendant was escalating or starting the fight. If you're looking at all the evidence in the best light for defendant, and that the verbal escalated to a physical within the bar, that you see the defendant withdrawing each time this is happening. You see him leaving the bar. You see him outside the bar, also telling him, hey, get the heck out of here. I am not going to fight you. It does not get to the point where he has to self-defend until he is actually physically attacked, and he was verbally threatened with immediate death. He said, I'm going to kill you now. You're going to die. And so that's at the point when he has to defend. So I think we get over both Smith and Bruner in that we get to physical contact. We get to what he believed to be something that could harm him, a weapon, a shiny metal object, and also the threat of immediate harm happening now. Therefore, I think that there was sufficient evidence of self-defense in this matter. I think the trial court should have gone ahead and submitted on it, and it was a reversible error not to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the proverbial case of the defendant who brought a knife to a wrestling match. According to the defendant's account, the only thing that happened here was that he was grabbed by his right shoulder. He was never struck. He never testified he saw a weapon in the defendant's hand. There's simply no evidence that injected the issue that he reasonably believed that lethal force, deadly force, was necessary to prevent death or serious physical injury.
But do we look at the level and degree of force? Do we look at the fact that self-defense was believed by him to be used? Do we look at the degree, or just the need for some type of self-defense?
Well, obviously, there's a different instruction if deadly force is involved. So merely having a situation where you're permitted to use ordinary self-defense is not enough. He has to prove that he was justified in using lethal or deadly force, and that requires a much higher
standard. Well, you don't have to be correct. You have to reasonably believe it. So you look at his state of mind and the situation as a whole in making that decision.
Yes, Your Honor. It's both subjectively and objectively. And here there was no evidence whatsoever that he subjectively believed it. In fact, he adamantly denied that he subjectively believed that he needed to use self-defense here to the police.
What's the problem in applying the regular rule that the fact finder is entitled to believe all part or none of the evidence from every witness? What's the problem with that?
I think the fact finder is entitled to believe that. I think there was insufficient evidence here to inject the issue, because the defendant denied both to the police and at trial that he
Well, but I mean, when you make a sufficiency argument, you don't look at the counter argument. You look at all of the evidence and reasonable inferences in favor of giving the instruction. And if you focus on that, why isn't there enough evidence in this case?
Yes. Well, there's a burden of production, which you held in Bruner, must be met first. But even if you do that, there simply wasn't enough evidence in this case. The defendant told the police that he did not
say. No. It doesn't matter what he said. I'm saying when you look at sufficiency, right, just like if whether or not the state proved their case, you look at all the evidence in favor and reasonable inferences, and you keep going back to the evidence against. I want you to, what's missing from the lack of evidence in favor of giving the instruction?
Well, the interesting question is, what is the evidence in favor of giving the instruction?
That's what I want you to focus on.
Yeah, and I'm trying to tell you that certainly didn't come from the defendant, neither a statement of the police or at trial. It didn't come from the third-party witness, Mr. Grimm, who testified that there was no knife on the victim when he approached the victim, and we know that the victim couldn't have disposed of the knife because the victim had quadriplegia and was paralyzed.
It's not the question if he's right. According to the defendant's brief, he says while he was out in the back urinating after he had been threatened by the victim, his defendant turned around, the victim came at him swinging his right arm at defendant and grabbing defendant's shoulder. Defendant saw a shiny metal object in victim Schmiderer's left hand coming towards defendant's face. Defendant tried to shove him off, but victim had him by the shirt. Defendant shoved him again and was able to get away. He was scared and afraid of the victim. He further testified, victim was yelling at him as he was getting away, I'm going to find you, I'm going to kill you. Why isn't that enough to inject self-defense? The jury doesn't have to believe all or part of it, but why isn't that enough to inject the issue if should the jury choose to believe it?
My right ear is not very good, but I thought I heard a knife in there somewhere. There's nothing in the record that said knife.
Shiny metal object.
Yeah, there was something metal. He saw something metal and shiny coming at him as the victim's hand came up. I have something shiny and metal that would be coming at him.
Why isn't that for the jury, whether that's enough for him to be afraid of that or not? Why does it make it not submissible? I don't understand.
Because he didn't testify that he feared for his life or serious physical injury.
So all the police shootings where someone sees a cell phone, you were going to go by whether it was actually a gun or a cell phone, or is it what the officer reasonably believes looking at it? I mean,
he didn't testify that he reasonably believed it was a weapon. The question wasn't even asked whether he reasonably believed it was a weapon. And I don't read her brief as saying that, you know, that shiny metal object was a weapon. He didn't say that to the police. He didn't say that at trial. There's no evidence whatsoever that he reasonably believed that there was a weapon.
The evidence was he was being swung at by a hand that was containing a shiny metal object. Whatever it was,
The word object is not in the quote either. I saw something shiny and metal. I saw something shiny and metal coming at my face.
Did there have to be a weapon for him to be able to use deadly force?
If his belief was objectively reasonable and if he subjectively held the belief, there's no evidence of either of those in this case.
Well, there's evidence regarding the reputation of this defendant, isn't there?
There is.
And his... over time, significant aggression against the defendant that, I forget what his nickname was, but, I mean, all of that can be considered as to whether his belief was reasonable.
Correct.
Can we consider the fact that he had prior injuries and to his head and was more vulnerable to serious physical injury from an attack?
If he had that belief and reasonably believed it, but there's no testimony that he had that belief or that he reasonably believed
it. See, it sounds
in fact,
like...
The testimony about PTSD says he would overreact in that situation.
It sounds like you're saying that even if there's evidence of an objectively reasonable belief, you can't submit the instruction unless the defendant testifies he had the subjective belief. Is that your position?
Well, Judge, your dissent in Bruner says there has to be both subjective. You'd refer repeatedly to both subjective and objective standards.
Well, defendant never has to testify, so that can't be
true.
The law.
You can draw an inference from some other testimony that, you know, he told me he was afraid. I mean, I don't know. But here you don't have any of that. He told nobody that he was afraid. In fact, he said the opposite. He said that I was able to deflect the hand by pushing it down. I shoved him to the ground. I walked away.
But can you infer the subjective belief from the same evidence from which you could infer, in a proper case, an objective belief? In other words, if you can infer an objectively reasonable belief, doesn't that carry with it an inference that there was a subjective belief?
I think when, you know, it's different where if you have a case where the person doesn't testify at all and the only evidence you have, I mean, here you have adamant denials that he had that subjective belief,
okay,
and he's the only one who knows.
This is my point. I thought we agreed at the beginning that the jury could believe all part or none of the evidence. So whether they testify or not shouldn't matter if that's the standard, right? If you can believe all part or none, it doesn't matter what he said, right?
I agree with that, but you know, there has to be... Here we have adamant denial, the only evidence that is available, and I believe, in fact, you said this in Bruner.
Counsel, this is exactly like Stiers. It says, contrary to the dissent's position, the jury could reasonably have accepted appellant's account of how his fight with Cheyenne transpired, but disbelieved his testimony about the amount of force he used based upon the physical evidence. A jury is permitted to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence and may believe all and... believe or disbelieve all part or none. And so in the identical situation, they found that was enough to inject self-defense because it's up to the jury to decide they don't believe him when he said he went away without using deadly force.
There's a key difference in Stiers, which is that the defendant testified the victim came at him with a knife and there was in that they had wrestled over the knife for a period of minutes.
And again, to address Judge Brackenridge's question, while the shiny object, one would think, allow him to infer there was some sort of weapon of whatever kind. What Bruner said was here there was no evidence of anything but a simple assault, a touching or grabbing. There was no evidence of any kind of more violent assault, which prior cases have said may permit you to use self-defense if you reasonably believe deadly force is necessary to protect yourself or another against serious physical injury or any forcible felony. So that is what's sufficient.
Judge, you yourself said in Bruner that there was no testimony that the defendant feared death or serious physical injury or any forcible felony, and that was sufficient for you to reject the submissibility of the claim. Even where there was a threat to kill with what Judge Wilson argued was inferentially a knife, that I'll slit your throat within a couple of hours, Judge Wilson thought that the couple of hours included immediately, and you rejected that because there was no testimony that the defendant feared death or imminently feared death or serious physical injury.
And the defendant said in that case he didn't think the person had a knife. So you're going to require a defendant to testify to invoke self-defense, it sounds like, or to have made a statement.
No, I think a person could witness that you know, the other person assaulted him and then the other person pulled the gun on him and he shot him back.
But a third-party witness can't ever testify as to what the defendant subjectively believed. So if you can't infer that from all of the other evidence, and I'm excluding your hypothetical where there's an out-of-court statement by the defendant, if there's no statement by the defendant about his state of mind, you're saying you can't ever infer a subjective belief from the circumstances.
Well, I suppose you could in a situation where, for example, the one person pulled a gun, the third-party witness says, yes, I saw him looking at the gun, you looked shocked, he pulled a gun back, shot him.
Well, that's this case.
Well,
it's just you don't believe
really
it.
Really, it's not.
Maybe neither do I, but a jury might. That he thought he was coming at him with a knife, so he went back at him with a knife. That's the same case. It's just a question of whether you find it credible.
Or even with some other kind of metal object, you're allowed to defend yourself, whether or not the person has a weapon, if you think you're going to be subject to serious physical injury or death.
Yes, you are. From my wedding ring, by that argument, me wearing a wedding ring, the defendant testifying I saw something shiny in his hand as it approached my face would be enough to get a self-defense instruction.
Well, but
most of the population wears wedding rings.
But it was before that time. There had been a history of aggression, and then there was a threat to kill. And then there's a shiny metal object. You can't just look at the shiny metal object. You got to look at the background to where you get to that point. And at that point in time, is a reasonable inference to show that this was a reasonable belief, there's a subjective belief.
Well, let's take Smith for example. In Smith, there were yelling threats, and you held that it was not enough. The defendant specifically testified that he thought the defendant was trying to find a gun from behind a dumpster, and you said nobody ever exhibited a weapon, nobody ever saw him exhibit a weapon, so there was no substantial evidence that the defendant had the subjective belief that would allow the submission of the self-defense instruction. In Bruner, you have in all these cases, you're escalating simple assaults into deadly confrontations, and you've held that's simply not enough to use lethal force. Here, the person was stabbed at least four times, maybe five, depending on whether you're looking at sentencing transcript or the trial testimony. One of those blows went all the way down to the spine and severed his spinal cord. Another one went through his chest all the way down, sliced his colon.
How does that not make it self-defense, though, necessarily?
Well,
it's certainly something a jury is going to pay a lot of attention to in deciding whether it was necessary. But the fact that you stabbed someone who you thought was trying to kill you or seriously injure you four times would not preclude self-defense. That's not been your argument.
Well, generally, if you can make an argument that the first fatal shot
That's never been argued here, or do I know any case that's addressed that issue? Do you have any?
The third-party witness said that there was no weapon. There was no weapon found. The victim is paralyzed. There simply was no weapon. I mean, if there was a weapon, the defendant absconded with a weapon, why would he leave it here?
Now you're running into Judge Fisher's problem, which is you can't consider that, all of that,
but
you said.
You can on reasonability. You can on whether there was a reasonable belief.
You can't determine what was reasonable belief at the time of the fight by what you find afterwards and then work backwards.
Rebuttal?
Yes, just briefly, Judge. I think just touching upon what the court was discussing, it's very clear that the reasonable belief does not need to later on turn out to be true. It's what he is thinking in the moment. So with regard to the shiny metal object, which is not only from his testimony, but if you look at the video, it's also in the police video. He and the police talk about the shiny metal object in the police video. And just because there wasn't a weapon found or it was determined there wasn't a weapon later on does not mean that he did not reasonably believe, based on all the circumstances with this particular victim, that claiming that he was...
Let's set aside, though, the reasonably objective standard. Where is the evidence that he subjectively feared an imminent attack?
I think it's in the escalation that evening. And then at the moment...
I think that all goes to whether it was an objectively reasonable belief. But where's the evidence that he subjectively believed it?
I think his own testimony. He does say that in testimony, that he was scared, his anxiety was high. This guy had jumped him from behind, and he told him he was going to kill him, and he had something in his hand. He says that in the testimony. So this is... You know, he subjectively says, I was afraid, I was scared, my anxiety was through the roof.
And you acknowledge you made many contrary statements.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
Under the standard, we would set those aside.
We would set those aside, and we do that because we want to give the jury all the evidence, and it's the province of the jury to determine the reliability and credibility of the witness. Thank you.
Case is submitted.